From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Kenneth Pollack, Senior Fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a prominent think tank based in Washington. And we are coming to you from Brookings headquarters in Washington, D.C. Kenneth Pollack specializes in political military affairs with expertise in Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and other nations of the Persian Gulf region. He is the author of several books, the most recent of which, Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. Ken Pollack began his career as an Iran-Iraq military analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and he has twice served on the staff of the National Security Council, dispensing analysis and advice regarding the Near East and Persian Gulf. From the stalemate in Syria to Iran's growing regional hegemony to the fight against the so-called Islamic State, we will talk with Ken Pollack about U.S. Mideast policy as he sees it evolving under the Trump administration. Ken Pollack, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And thank you for hosting us here. Well, Ken, let's first talk about the fledgling Trump administration. What can we glean thus far from statements and actions by President Trump regarding U.S. policy toward the greater Middle East?
Well, let's remember that every American presidential administration starts out in a rocky fashion. President Obama, President George W. Bush, President Clinton, whom I worked for, all of them had rough transitional periods. I think the first President Bush was the only one who was smooth sailing. That said, this one clearly has been rockier than most. And I think that that stems from the fact that you have a president with no policy experience who probably wasn't expecting that he was going to be president and hadn't really picked out his staff. What we've seen since then is a clash of two different sets of very important elements. We've seen a number of statements from the president, which I think have been very alarming to a lot of people around the world and to a great many Americans as well, because they really have flown in the face of 50 years of American policy. On the other hand, we're seeing him choose a group of advisors which increasingly looks like a very smart, competent, and experienced group of advisors, at least on the foreign policy side. When you talk about people like General H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, these are all extremely bright, extremely experienced officials who actually have very moderate views toward American foreign policy, particularly toward the Middle East. And I think that what we're all waiting to figure out is just how much the president's statements will actually guide the new policy and how much will be the experience and the moderate views of the cabinet members he's choosing.
Well, you mentioned General H.R. McMaster, who is now the new National Security Advisor after the resignation of General Michael Flynn. You served on the National Security Council. He's in the process of looking at the staffing and seeing how he's going to perhaps reorganize. What are the chances of him taking control, given the tensions and some of the clashes that we've seen in the past?
I've known H.R. McMaster for over two decades. He is exceptionally bright, competent. He is good at almost everything that he turns his attention to. He's obviously a tremendous battlefield commander, but he's also demonstrated a real understanding that military force can only be part of a wider foreign policy panoply. He understands the importance of economics and politics. And something that's critically important in his new job, he understands the difficulty of making big bureaucracies work properly. For all of those reasons, I hope that he is going to grab control over the National Security Council and the wider American national security process, and he's going to run it the way that he knows it needs to be run. My one fear is that because he is lower in rank than General Mattis was and then General Kelly was, because perhaps he is not quite as experienced as a Rex Tillerson, I hope that he doesn't feel like he needs to defer to those people and that instead he will see himself as their full equal and will run that process. I think that the United States will be best served if he does so. And I think in truth, we are likely to get the best policy toward the Middle East if that's the case. Because one of the things that I learned at the National Security Council is that while good process is not a guarantee of good policy, bad process is a guarantee of bad policy.
Well, speaking of process and relationships, you mentioned Defense Secretary Mattis and Rex Tillerson, the new Secretary of State. But some critics are actually more worried about the role of Steve Bannon, the chief strategist in the White House, and his potential role or his current role on the National Security Council. Does his role worry you?
Obviously, Steve Bannon has said a lot of things that I don't necessarily agree with, but we don't yet know exactly what his role is going to be in the Trump administration or specifically in the formulation of foreign policy. Again, I've sat in on NSC meetings where there were political advisors present, and domestic politics is always wrapped up in American foreign policy. So I think it'd be naive to believe that you can exclude them entirely. But we just don't know what role Steve Bannon will have. My hope is that professionals like McMaster, Mattis, Tillerson, that they're going to be the ones who the president is going to listen to, and they're going to be the ones who are really calling the shots.
Thus far, Kenneth Pollack, we've seen Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and the State Department somewhat sidelined on foreign policy. The State Department is normally the preeminent voice on foreign policy, notwithstanding the very important role of the White House. How, again, do you see Rex Tillerson's role and his level of influence going forward on foreign policy?
Yeah, this is a big question, Carol, and I don't think that we know yet. Part of the problem is that Mr. Tillerson doesn't have a team at all. It's just him sitting over there in that big building with a bunch of professional staffers. Until he gets a full team of personnel to man all the middle levels of management at the State Department, it's going to be very hard for him to have that kind of an impact. I mean, again, we tend to personalize foreign policy and policymaking, but the more that you've served in the U.S. government, the more that you recognize that it's the full strength of the institutions that actually give these organizations their power, and you need to have the personnel in place. In addition, Tillerson is not someone who seems to have had a relationship with President Trump before he got named Secretary of State. I think he's figuring that out. I think he's figuring out his relationship to Secretary Mattis. And now he's got a new national security advisor. He's going to have to figure out that as well. But I do think that moving forward, that's going to be a very important thing to see, how much influence Rex Tillerson has. And a last point on that, worth keeping in mind that what we've seen progressively over the last couple of administrations has been the slow diminution of the role of the Secretary of State and increasingly a shift in foreign policy making over to the White House.
Indeed, we did witness that under the Obama administration. Let's move on to policy towards Syria, a very tragic situation, a crisis that we've seen evolve since the collapse of the Arab Spring. We saw an uprising peaceful in 2011 and now morphed into almost a full-blown civil war. You have the so-called Islamic State on the rise, but on the other hand, you have the regime of Bashar al-Assad attacking civilians, attacking the mainstream rebel opposition. We saw Russia come in on the side to prop up Bashar al-Assad in 2015, and we see attempts to revive peace talks again and again. I think we are going to witness another round of potential peace talks. So the question to you is, are conditions in place, in your view, for such diplomatic overtures to succeed? And if not, what is missing?
I don't think that anyone can look at Syria today and believe that we've got the potential for a good solution to that conflict anywhere in the offing. I'll start with the United States and its foreign policy, and I'll say that I felt that the greatest mistake of the Obama administration when it looked at Syria was to see Syria as primarily a problem of terrorism. The problem of Syria is a civil war. It is a state that has collapsed. It is a regime that is trying to reassert its control over the populace by slaughtering its own people. It is the spillover of refugees onto neighboring countries, as well as a whole variety of militants and just radical ideologies that are flowing from it. It is a quintessential civil war. And yes, there is terrorism, because terrorism is always a byproduct of every civil war. And the mistake that the U.S. made under Obama, and the mistake that I'm afraid we're going to repeat under Trump, is this narrow focus on Daesh, as if Daesh is the problem. Daesh is not the problem.
And Daesh, of course, is the Arab word for the Islamic State.
Correct. And Daesh is not the problem in Syria. Daesh is a symptom of the problem. The problem is the wider civil war. And I don't think that any American policy, or frankly, any foreign policy by any country towards Syria that focuses laser-like on Daesh is going to wind up solving the Syrian crisis for anyone in any way. And I think that the idea that the United States should be partnering with Russia, with Iran, with the Assad regime against Daesh, I think this is madness. It will make the civil war worse, not better.
But that is precisely what President Trump intends to do, where he has broadcast this desire to destroy ISIS and potentially ally ourselves, that is the United States, with Russia. But as you said, many critics say embracing Russia and its brutal tactics, as well as those of the Bashar al-Assad regime, could actually stoke anti-American sentiment and encourage radicalization among Muslims around the world.
I see no evidence to indicate that the Assad regime will be able to regain control over Syria and stabilize and pacify the country. Far too many Syrians despise the Assad regime. They are determined to resist it because of its atrocities against the people. Russia is allied with the Assad regime, and therefore Russia cannot be an answer to the problem. Their goal right now is to put Assad back in full control. That's not going to result in an end to the civil war. And I think that if the Trump administration simply pursues this notion that all we have to do in Syria is destroy ISIS, and a way to do that is by joining with the Russians, well, we may wind up destroying ISIS. We can do huge damage to it. The problem is we won't address the problems of the civil war, and we will find ourselves confronting the son of ISIS tomorrow.
What would you recommend the Trump administration do if they were open to other alternatives?
I think that the only answer, we've seen this time and again throughout history, is to end the civil war. That means suppressing the fighting. That means forging a power-sharing arrangement among all of the different Syrian factions so that every Syrian community gets political power and economic benefits equal to its demographic weight. We've seen this time and again. When you get that, you can put an end to the civil war. And once you've put an end to the civil war, then it's a matter of building a new country on top of that. It's the only chance, though, of moving past the tragic circumstances of Syria today.
What happens to Bashar al-Assad?
I think under those circumstances, Bashar al-Assad will have to leave. I do not think that he can be president of a new Syria. I doubt that he can be part of a new Syrian political formula. There are far too many Syrians who despise him because of the way that he has treated his own people.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Kenneth Pollack, Senior Fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent think tank based here in Washington. And we are coming to you from Brookings headquarters in Washington. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Musa Manaja from Gombe State in Nigeria. Well, back to our special guest, Kenneth Pollack, here at the Brookings Institution. Well, Ken, from Syria, let's move on now to Iraq. As we speak, the Iraqi security forces are trying to take over ISIS position in Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq. We know that U.S. troops are moving close to the front line. But ultimately, to be successful, critics say that the Baghdad government must do more to accommodate the Sunni minority population within the government and society. How do you see this fight going?
First off, Iraq is in many ways very much like Syria. The conflict is different. The Iraqis have already been through a major civil war and they've got much more American assistance. But the fact of the matter is that both are similar in that both are ultimately civil wars where you have different communities with very different ideas about who should be in charge and what power should look like and are fearful of the other. We're doing, I think, a very good job of helping the Iraqis to defeat Daesh militarily. But as everybody keeps saying, and they're right to say it, the military victory does not necessarily translate into a meaningful political solution. And that's the mistake that the United States has made several times before in Iraq. In 2003 and again in 2011, we won military victories and then walked away and allowed Iraq to descend back into civil war. The United States cannot allow that to happen again. Iraqis shouldn't want it to happen again. But that's going to mean building off of this military victory in a way that we haven't in the past. It's going to mean real national reconciliation, bringing the Sunnis back into the government, making them feel comfortable, giving them positions and authority, decentralizing power from the federal government so that they feel like they've got a say in their own lives. But we also need to recognize that it needs to go beyond that. That's a critical part of it, but it's not the only part. We need to help the Iraqis to build a new government that can care for all of its people. Sunni, Shia, Turkmen, you name it. There are far too many Iraqis who continue to live in poverty, who continue to live without electricity, who continue to try to live without jobs. Iraq is a fabulously rich country, and yet its people live in poverty. It speaks to the problems of this government, which has been crippled by inefficiency and politics. And again, the United States and the other members of the coalition who've all rallied together to beat up on Daesh militarily, we need to sustain that commitment even after the retaking of Mosul to put Iraq on a stable political and economic trajectory.
But you know as well as I do, Ken Pollack, that Iran wields enormous power in Iraq, which is dominated by a Shiite-led government, Prime Minister Abadi. And we know that he knows all of these factors that you're discussing, the need for reconciliation with the Sunni community, for decentralization of power. But he is hamstrung by local politics, by strong Shiite politicians, and the influence of Iran. So how can he do that?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think that it's going to be a very important one for the Trump administration to confront. Because, first point, most of the people, I would say, in fact, all of the people he's put in charge of his critical foreign policy agencies, all have deep experience with Iraq, and they understand exactly what I just told you about the importance of political and economic solutions, not just military. They're also deeply concerned about Iran, exactly as you put it, Carol. They believe that Iran exerts a great influence in Iraq. They see Iran as menacing American allies all across the region, things that they want to push back on. And I think that that is important. But what the United States is going to have to do is going to have to figure out a way to simultaneously push back and contain Iran across the region, which we'll talk more about in a minute, but not turn Iraq into a battlefield between Iran and America. That's not going to work in particular for Iraq. The good news is that Iraq is too important to both the United States and Iran to let that happen. And so if we're willing to figure out ways to help Iraq move forward that don't cross Iran's red lines, I think that there can be tacit cooperation. Right? We're not going to cooperate directly because our interests are too inimical. But at the end of the day, Iran wants to see an Iraq that is not in a state of civil war, that is not half controlled by radical Sunni Salafi groups like ISIS. They're not going to want to see a central government that can't control most of its territory. And so if the United States helps Iraq to rebuild a central government that can deliver services to its people, if it brings the Sunni community back in so you have a reunified Iraq, at least a reunified Arab Iraq, those are all things that Iran needs too. And so it creates a basis to help Iraq that shouldn't pick a fight between the U.S. and Iran over Iraq.
Well, I just heard you say a reunified Arab Iraq, which leads me now to ask you about the role of the Kurds in Kurdistan, because we know they have long wanted greater autonomy and even potentially independence. They're a very strong ally of the United States against Daesh, the so-called Islamic State. How do you see their role and the state of Iraq going forward? Can it stay together? Or should there be some kind of greater autonomy, potentially even independence for Kurdistan?
I think this is a huge question for Iraq and for the United States moving forward. Historically, I think if you know the history of Iraq, you know that the incorporation of part of Kurdistan into Iraq has been a tragic failure for both the Kurds and the Iraqis. They have been in conflict basically since the formation of the state after World War I. If you think about the period between 1961 and 1991, a 30-year period, there was warfare, open war, between the Kurds and the central government in Baghdad for 20 of those 30 years. And during that period, you had horrible, horrible massacres, including the Anfal campaign against them. This is a bad marriage. It needs to be broken up. The problem, of course, though, is that's easier said than done, right? You're going to have to figure out where the boundary lies. You're going to have to figure out what to do about oil, about the status of Kirkuk, about other minorities. There are any number of very delicate and complex issues. And it's why, from my perspective, again, historically speaking, I think that Kurdistan does need to be independent from Iraq. I think that is in the best interests of the Kurds, and I think that it is in the best interests of Arab Iraqis as well. But you can't just do it immediately, right? And you can't just do it unilaterally. That is likely to cause more conflict between the two of them. And so what I'd like to see the United States and its allies do is help broker a process. Over 5 or 10 years, allow Baghdad and Erbil to negotiate a peaceful separation of Kurdistan from the rest of Iraq, very much along the lines of how the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic divided Czechoslovakia. That's the idea. That's the goal. But we also have to recognize that's going to be very hard for Baghdad and Erbil, for Iraqis and Kurds to do without an outside mediator. And that, unfortunately, is a role the United States, I think, is going to have to play.
But that leads me now to ask you about the reaction from Turkey, from President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who sees, sometimes we get the impression that he sees the Kurds, who are obviously important U.S. allies and certainly deserve, given their history, autonomy, if not independence. He sees them as an enemy because of the large Kurdish population in Turkey and his inability perhaps to accommodate them. How do you see that working because of him and Turkey?
Obviously, this is another huge question. And yes, I think that one of the reasons why it needs to be a process and not simply a unilateral declaration is because Turkey's interests are so deeply bound up in this question. And I think that all of us, Iraqis, Kurds, Americans, we have to be respectful of Turkey's interests and its fears. They need to be part of the process. But now I'm going to pick up on a word that you used, Carol, and I think it was exactly the right word. You said sometimes. President Erdogan sometimes sees these moves by the Kurds as being inimical to Turkey's interests. And obviously, we know a lot of other Turks do as well. But we've also seen President Erdogan much more comfortable with the independence of Iraqi Kurdistan at a variety of periods of time over the last few years. And I think that it's because he recognizes that an independent Iraqi Kurdistan ultimately could be beneficial to Turkey economically, potentially politically, depending on how Iraqi Kurdistan behaved toward the Kurdish population of Turkey. And again, it's not a reason to say that the Iraqi Kurds can't go independent. It's simply a reason to say that the process needs to be negotiated and all of the different parties who have interests need to be brought into it to make sure that they feel comfortable with it. No one is going to get everything that they want. If they do, it's not going to be a lasting and enduring solution. But everyone has to come away feeling like, okay, we got the minimum that we need.
As we close, Ken Pollack, I'd like to turn back to Iran. We alluded to Iran earlier in the conversation, the growing hegemony of Iran in the region, whether with respect to Iraq, Yemen, Syria, also Lebanon. It makes the Gulf Arab states very nervous. And then, of course, we have the Iran nuclear deal, which was negotiated under the Obama administration. What strategy do you think the United States should adopt under the Trump administration vis-a-vis Iran, both with respect to its increasing hegemony and then on the nuclear front?
Carol, I hope what you've heard from me is a strategic perspective on the region. I try to think about it holistically. And I think that one of the problems that Americans have had and American administrations have had over the last 10 or 15 years has been that we haven't been thinking strategically. We simply see things in isolation. The Iranians are doing something here, they're doing there, and we just try to deal with it in these discrete terms. It doesn't work that way. I think we have to see Iran as a regional player and a regional problem that needs to be dealt with at that level. So the first point that I'd make is just pushing back on the Iranians wherever they pop up, this isn't going to work. And we need to develop a region-wide strategy for how, as I said, we're going to push back on Iran and contain Iranian influence. Because there's no question that Iranian influence in the region is largely detrimental to American interests and to the interests of most of our allies. Iran, at heart, is an anti-status quo power. They want to overturn the power structure of the region. Now, certainly there are lots of people out there who'd like things to be different, but that doesn't necessarily mean that what the Iranians are doing is the right thing, because all they want is to see revolution that overturns things and empowers them. So that's point number one. But point number two is we also have to recognize that the Iranians, as we say in English, are not 10 feet tall. The truth of the matter is they're a mid-sized country. They're big by regional standards. They're nothing compared to the United States. And we can't be giving them more power than they deserve. The truth of the matter is that Iran has never successfully started a civil war. They've never successfully overthrown another government. They've tried. But mostly what they do is they go looking for problems and then they make them worse. And what that ought to tell us then is if we want to push back on Iran and we want to limit Iran's ability to make problems in the region, the most important thing that we can do is help the regional states solve their own problems. Right? Civil wars like what we see in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Libya, this is what Iran lives on. Right? This is how they got into Lebanon. They go looking for those problems and they make them worse. We've got to help solve them. And, you know, we've seen where we do that, the Iranians get pushed out. Look at Iraq in 2008, where the United States finally did the right thing. We built a strong Iraqi military that was non-sectarian. We built a government that was able to rule. We actually secured the Iraqi people, and they pushed the Iranians out. They limited Iran's influence better than the United States ever could. And that should tell us the first step to pushing back on the Iranians and limiting their influence, build strong regional states.
Well, in Iraq, you may be right in that regard, but they're back in Iraq as we speak with greater power. What about the nuclear deal? Mr. Trump originally said he wants to rip it up, but now possibly wouldn't do that. Do you see the nuclear deal as a very positive thing that should be enforced and continued under this administration?
I won't say that it's a very positive thing, but I think that it is a positive thing. I wasn't terribly happy with the deal that the United States negotiated. I think that we could have gotten a better one. But I nevertheless think that it was a positive development, and I think that it would be a mistake to scrap it. And I think that the Trump administration is increasingly recognizing it. And I think that they're recognizing that whether they like it or not, whether Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel likes it or not, the rest of the world likes it. They don't want to see Iran with a nuclear weapon, and they don't want to see conflict with Iran. And the deal, by and large, takes both of those things off the table for at least 10 or 15 years. And the problem is that if the United States were to unilaterally rip up the deal, the rest of the world would blame us. They would side with the Iranians. And if we tried to renegotiate, we'd get a worse deal. But the deal shouldn't be the totality of America's Iran policy. I think this is one of the criticisms leveled constantly against the Obama administration. It's one I agree with, that the Obama administration was only interested in the nuclear deal and really didn't care about what else Iran did in the region and was unwilling to push back on Iran anywhere else in the region for fear of jeopardizing the nuclear deal. My own perspective is that the Iranians see the nuclear deal as transactional. They gave up their nuclear program in return for our lifting sanctions. That's it. They haven't allowed the nuclear deal to limit their aggressive behavior anywhere else in the region. We shouldn't either. We shouldn't limit our actions. We shouldn't limit the actions of our allies. And while I wouldn't like just to get us involved in a war with Iran, I think it's important that we demonstrate to the Iranians that they don't get a free pass And they don't get the ability to push elsewhere in the region just because they agreed to the nuclear deal.
Kenneth Pollack is a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Ken, thank you very much for your insights. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.